Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on, that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically popular. Now, for most people in the country, your electric bill is not determined by competition from private profit-seeking enterprises. Rather, it's determined by private providers granted territorial monopolies by state governments, and with those monopolies, regulated by state governments. And this system has not been working out that well. But it doesn't have to be this way. Today we're joined by John Sanders of the John Locke Foundation, a free market think tank in North Carolina, who helped to win an effort to avoid expensive and unreliable energy in the state. John, welcome.
Thanks, James, for having me.
What did the governor want from your state's private energy providers?
Yes, yeah, so our Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, came out with what he wanted, a clean energy plan for North Carolina. And it was a very specific plan for clean energy in that it was really just going to be renewables. He wanted to replace our traditional electricity generating sources of coal and natural gas. We also have a lot of nuclear with solar and wind, with battery arrays backing them up.
And that's something that's not just your governor wants it. A lot of governors have tried to mandate the switch from fossil fuels, nuclear energy, to wind and solar.
Yeah, so what he wanted to do was by 2030 get the emissions from energy generation in North Carolina down by 70%, and then by 2050 get to what's called carbon neutral, where there would essentially be no emissions from the generation of electricity. Now, we've been in North Carolina and the United States in general been reducing our emissions from electricity by market forces. Ours are nearly cut in half, so we're pretty, in fact, I'm expecting when we get the new numbers in next month from the federal government that we will have achieved over halfway since 2005 of reducing our energy-based emissions, but that's been through more price-effective natural gas, through fracking, and being able to replace a lot of coal. We used to have 60-some% of our generation from coal, and now that's down to about 17%, and it's mostly natural gas and nuclear.
Mm-hmm. So the governor wants wind and solar. What did you want from the state's private utility providers?
Well, what I wanted specifically would be to retain things as they are. So because as I'm a ratepayer in North Carolina as well as a public policy analyst, paid off capital, working capital, is less expensive than having to build a lot of new capital. Mm-hmm. However, the General Assembly sought to put the governor's clean energy plan into statute, and it passed through the House, and they were pretty much going to give him everything. When it went to the state Senate, they took a look at it. They took a look at a report that we put out that talked about the great expense of especially wind and solar in comparison with nuclear and natural gas of building new and trying to maintain reliability. And so they put in guardrails and they said, "All right, fine, we'll." Put the 70% goal by 2030 or around, and the 100% carbon neutral by 2050. But the path that the Utilities Commission can take going forward will have to protect the reliability of the grid and have to be the least cost path going forward. So those were two very, very important guardrails that prevents a lot of wind and solar from just being uploaded and then, you know, we get stuck with rolling blackouts and extremely expensive power bills.
You mentioned something earlier that I want you to elaborate on, which is it's better to have the capital already paid off than develop a new one. So what you're saying is, like, you have a bunch of electricity providers, you've already paid for them, you don't need to build new more, but through the utility system we're going to, can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, absolutely. So basically, in state law in North Carolina, it's like this pretty much everywhere. Given that it's a state-based monopoly, the state grants a monopoly to, in our case, it's pretty much Duke Energy. That's about 95% of the state gets their energy from Duke. So in return for this monopoly, they have to meet certain standards. They have to, they have to meet cost and reliability standards, but their shareholders are also guaranteed a profit. So if the Utilities Commission tells them to build something, then they get to take it out from us in our rates. They get to make a rate case and get the money back plus a guaranteed rate of return. And the system makes sense in the monopoly sense of things. And it was based on the idea that electricity provision was a natural monopoly, which I think time is proving that not necessarily to be the case. That being said, once the power plants are built and they've been paid for through the rates, customers no longer have to pay for them, and the electricity that's generated from them is just on the cost of the raw materials and generation operations and maintenance. Those are the things that we have to worry about as ratepayers. But if we're going to close plants down, if we're going to close working plants down, and we've got 9 gigawatts of working coal in North Carolina, if we're going to close all that down, then we've got to replace it with something, and they're going to be new builds, and they're going to be something that we have to pay for as ratepayers.
Yeah, instead of just cashing in on the cheap electricity that you've already paid for, now we're going to. And the utilities, by the way, this is one of the things that I think a lot of people don't recognize. It's like, utilities are not necessarily conflicted on this. They're not necessarily while they may have that reputation, they're not necessarily for fossil fuel electricity generations. They would love to build wind and solar and then to replace what they've already earned a profit on, and then they would like to have those non-dispatchable sources, so that they're required to, in addition to build gigawatts worth of wind and solar farms, backup plants to support the state when they're not wearing. So it's replacing things that they've already cashed in on with two sources of new income.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. As far as what new generation they build, I mean, there is some desire to make sure that they're building reliable plants. So there's a desire for, especially for natural gas, because they can be built quicker than nuclear. And they don't like being hauled before the Utilities Commission and the General Assembly to explain why we had a blackout. They didn't appreciate that a couple of years ago. So, they're not entirely desirous of intermittent sources that can't be relied upon, except for the whims of nature. But that being said, solar and wind, one of the nice things about it from the perspective of shareholders for publicly traded utility company is that not only do you get to build them to replace the amount of generation that is being closed, but you have to overbuild, because it's the only way to approximate the reliability that you have from closing coal and natural gas. As you have to build, 6 to 8 times as many in order to make up for the reliability that you're losing.
All right, so on this battle for the legislature and utility regulators, on the one hand, you've got the governor calling for more wind and solar, and on the other hand, you've got yourself calling for continued nuclear and natural gas. Who makes the decision about which side wins?
Well, in this case, the decision was made by the General Assembly. They were influenced by research published by Locke that looked at all of these things, looked at the reliability, looked at the cost of of natural gas, of nuclear versus solar and wind, looked at other aspects of it, including land usage, which is a major thing. I mean, one of the reasons why the environmentalists push solar and wind is because they're thinking about environmental issues, but they're not thinking about the enormous amounts of land that have to go into wind arrays and solar fields. So, mm-hmm. You're talking many, many, many square miles to approximate the amount of power that you can get from a reliable nuclear plant it's almost 100% reliable that you can get in a square mile. Mm-hmm. The entire footprint of the plant, parking lot and everything.
So your Crossroads report that you mentioned brings up the land use issue, covers a lot of stuff. Like, how did that affect lawmakers' thinking on this issue?
Well, it affected them by getting them to realize that we were on the brink of making a very bad decision, of leaving it up to the activists that would be put in place by our Democratic governor, who is in the pocket of a lot of these environmental organizations, and staffing the Utilities Commission with his appointments. They would have no desire to worry about reliability and cost.
So that is, I mean, that's an essential thing, because that's essentially what we are asking our regulators to do, which is care about reliability and cost. As in, when we want to make sure that we're paying for cheap electricity, that you're not charging monopoly prices, and that it's reliable. Your lights come on when you flip on their switch. But lawmakers seem to get distracted by those goals, like the idea that there's catastrophic climate change coming if we don't do something about our carbon dioxide emissions is a huge draw for a lot of lawmakers who think that, well, reliability and cost is not all that important if we're destroying our environment. So can you talk about that debate and how that's playing out in the state legislature?
Sure, yeah. That debate is very frustrating on this end of things, because there's just an assumption built in our media and in our public talk about it that we're the problem. As it turns out, the United States, North Carolina, your state, we're cutting emissions. Like I said earlier, our emissions from energy are way down. We've cut them nearly in half organically. It hasn't even needed to be done with legislation. It's just a byproduct of the efficiency that comes about through a free market system, including the desire to find a new way of freeing up oil and gas trapped in shale rock. So the United States has reduced more emissions than any other nation on Earth. We're one of the few nations that have been reducing emissions. But even if you combine the entire European Union, we've outdone them. Meantime, a lot of burgeoning economies, most of the nations in the world, have increased their carbon dioxide emissions since 2005, and that's the Paris Accord number. That's the baseline year. That's like the worst year for emissions. And so
the Paris Accord being like international set of standards that some nations have agreed to.
Right. So that's kind of like the baseline that the left like to look at. And North Carolina's cut ours down by about half. The United States has cut theirs down by a significant amount. I need to look at the new numbers that have come out, but we continue to increase. But meantime, what we've done has been completely erased five times over or so by what China has added. And specifically for the state of North Carolina, the most that we can close down in coal, in our coal plants, like I said, is 9 gigawatts. China in the next 5 years is going to open 42 times that much in coal. So the idea that we can do anything to help the planet by closing down our coal plants has been absolutely obliterated by what China is doing. However, we can bear all the cost of what we're doing to ourselves. And so China won't bear any of those financial burdens that North Carolina will bear, and that's what I'm worried about, is we're chasing something that's impossible at great, great expense to us when there is another way. If we really want to have zero emissions energy, we know in efficient energy, we know how to do it. It's nuclear. It just takes a while to build.
If they're allowed to build at all, but that's a different federal issue. But I wanted to dwell on this point because I think you've done a really clever thing. Like, the fact that China is building a lot of coal plants and is increasing their carbon dioxide, I think a lot of people have heard about. But you've done a clever thing to note and contextualize this particular point. Can you explain your concept of China carbon time?
So, okay. my concept of China carbon time is sort of based on something that the Tax Foundation does every year, where they have Tax Freedom Day. That's the day where you are no longer working for the federal government, based on how much taxes are taken out of your annual salary. And in different states, tax freedom, and the state government. So in different states, Tax Freedom Day comes at different times. So my thinking was, how do I show in a day, at what point in time does the best your state can ever do? So if you get your state back to a state of nature where there were no carbon dioxide emissions at all, if you get down to zero, at what point in time each day would the additional emissions coming from China, not total emissions, but just the additional emissions coming from China since 2005, take over? And for most states, except for Texas and maybe California and a couple of others, it's shortly after midnight.
As in, not a whole day.
Yeah.
And
that's so, just China. I'm not even adding in India and Turkey and several other of the major producers of emissions.
Mm-hmm. And the point being on this is that, the goal that you're trying to accomplish cannot be accomplished with the means that you're looking at, which is shutting down North Carolina fossil fuel electricity generation is not going to do anything about carbon dioxide emissions on the global scale, and it's the global scale that matters. It's all costs and no benefits. So
right.
That's compelling to me. That's a really important thing. But I'm not an elected official. Elected officials are weighing a lot of things when they're responding to Governor Cooper's request to gradually or not so gradually move to wind and solar. So what are the things that they're weighing on, and what kind of ammunition did you help give them?
So some of the things that they weigh on are they have to deal with constituents who are very much in favor of wind and solar. There's kind of an idea, I believe, in just the popular conception that it's, what's the big deal? It's like unplugging one power plant and plugging in another, and mm-hmm. and the idea that, for example,
the theory is somewhat good. It's like, look, you don't have to pay for coal because the wind blows without having to generate it. Sunshine shines every day. You can just capture all these free energy sources.
Right, right. Do you remember when the eclipse happened earlier this year, that there were all these news reports. What are they going to do? What are these solar plants going to do when the sun goes behind the cloud? How are they going to manage it? And I was over here going, this happens every night. Why are we worried about this?
The sun, in fact, does set in North Carolina.
Yeah.
It's not the British Empire.
That's true. So the things that the legislature were looking for, they did take seriously the fact that the reason that we even set up this state monopoly to begin with is a state-blessed monopoly, I should say, mm-hmm. is that we wanted to ensure that people would have reliable, adequate, and low-cost access to electricity. It's not a luxury good. It is something that we need for our very survival. It's a basic human necessity. And now it's also, it's an input cost, a primary input cost in everything that's built and made in this state. So the last thing you want to do is just arbitrarily increase its cost and make it where it's something that you can't rely upon.
So how do you get, so you've won a victory on this, the legislature rejected the governor's request. How do you get a better electorate that cares about this issue?
Well, there are two ways about it, and one way is not good, and that would be we start experiencing the fruits of bad policy. Mm. We start having really high rates. We start having issues with reliability, and our Christmas Eve blackouts of 2022 kind of gave us a warning and got some people's attention that might not have happened. It was interesting seeing the governor try to spin the thing by saying, hey, well, you know, solar energy worked as expected, which was absolutely true. Solar energy was not available to help out at all in the early morning hours when the sun was still down and we were having issues with frozen lines and natural gas and not able to get the promised electricity power that we were supposed to get from elsewhere. So but at the meantime, nobody mentioned the fact except me that our nuclear power plants, if you looked at the graph of how they were performing, it was at the very top. It was a flat line. In fact, you might have thought it was a grid line because it was so undisturbed.
So that's one way of is that people have, well, like politicians will or lawmakers will keep going down the path to 100% renewables until it does result in high electrical costs and unreliable electricity, and then hopefully your lawmakers can do something about that. What's the other way? Optimistic way.
The more optimistic way is that we get a lot of feedback within the community arguing. We're starting to see this in different counties and in different pockets in the state where they would be affected by a lot of land use going to solar or wind, and saying and questioning whether this is the right thing to do, looking at some of the alternate costs, looking at the problems with offshore wind and coastal tourism, our beach views, our whales and sea turtles and many other animals that are affected along with the costs of them. So just continuing to provide information on all of these things and asking questions and pointing out, like, what I'm trying to do is you know, these have many, many expenses that have to be taken into account, but especially pointing out the risk to reliability and cost. Because that's what, like you said earlier, was, you know, power at the flip of a switch. If that's taken away, then we've lost something big, and we're the United States of America, and we really shouldn't be dealing with worries like that.
If only it were so. there are a lot of... And there are a lot of things that I wish our country could do better, and this is one of them. This is an issue that we're working on, a lot of people are working on, but there's something about this debate that continually frustrates me, which is these major changes are a set of targets to happen in the future. And usually that's when our lawmakers, who are not, or who are making the decision today about electricity generation things in the future, they're not going to be in office when the consequences of their actions are occur. And so it's this weird political debate where there is a market, there is a constituency for among people who are going to vote to try to encourage decreased carbon emissions, regardless, as you note, of whether we're doing good on reducing carbon emissions already without these mandates. But there's a political constituency for that. There's certainly a large series of interest groups who are very intent on ensuring that state policy decarbonizes everything that they can, including utility scale electricity generations. And the political calculus for them, for these mandates to happen in the future, are extraordinarily positive. That is, you can please these interest groups now and face no electoral consequences, even if this results in negative consequences in the future. That's some terrible political calculus, but you can beat that. You can beat this through some of the work that you've done, like your Crossroads report. So, like, what else you got?
Well, one of the other things that I think will help in the near future is we're running into cross purposes with these environmental programs and the future of electricity. We've been for many, many years becoming much more efficient in our use of electricity, so we've been able to get away with our electricity provision maybe growing a little bit less reliable, just because we're not using it as much per person. It's a good thing. And again, that's something that you see in the free market is there's always a push for greater efficiency of resources. However, the advent of AI, these major data centers, these things are huge power sucks. They require enormous amounts of power. I read recently that to do a single AI search, and Google is adding AI to all of their searches, each one takes about as much power as it does to power up a cell phone. Every single one. Furthermore, the Biden administration and the Cooper administration in North Carolina want to greatly increase the amount of electric vehicles, things that need to be charged. You know, our current vehicles, most the contemporary, the internal combustion engines, they have their power source within them. You know, they're converting power and making their own power. What they want to do is outsource all of the power that's generated by gas and diesel within the cars and trucks to power plants, which would be an enormous increase, and it would also require, for most people, plugging in at night when the sun is not out. So we're at cross purposes with the power that we want to generate and the power that a growing nation is going to be needing very soon.
So you bring up a couple of things that I want your thoughts about, because you've also, I mean, there are some good things that are going on here. We're the competitive environmental pressures and the fact that electricity costs money encourages decreases in emissions already, as you've noted. There's a lot of changes in the technological frontier that we're facing, including both supply and demand. The demand things that you mentioned are the AI and the electrical vehicles. But isn't there a technological... another thing that has changed, too, is that solar panels and wind turbines seem to be a lot less expensive than they used to be. Are there any other technological changes that can be beneficial to us in these political debates?
Well, the nice thing about technological change is that a lot of people don't see them coming. because there's one visionary out there who's got the idea, and we often think of something, we often see a problem and think, well, I can't see the solution to it, so there must not be one, and therefore we should run the government to have them find the solution for us, where that's an entrepreneurial opportunity for somebody else who's got a vision and can make it and can actualize it. This is a very fancy way of saying, I don't have the answers to all of these things, but I'm not saying that those answers aren't out there. I can think of some things like carbon capture. That's technology that's not quite there yet, but it could be. There could be an ability in the near future to make hydrogen work, where you can convert natural gas to hydrogen. I know there's some talk about that, and in North Carolina, Duke would like to plan it so that their new natural gas facilities could possibly be converted to hydrogen in the near future, if that technology ever gets workable. Maybe eventually more battery technology can be cheaper and perhaps last a little bit longer than 4 hours. There are opportunities. Maybe we could find more workable ways around the monopoly model, where we could have smaller communities to be able to have their own power sources. And in that case, even solar would work in certain locations where you could have smaller wind the smaller solar arrays would work for certain communities that can't be served traditionally as well by the power monopoly. So there are things. And of course, small modular nuclear reactors, SMRs, could be very, very useful in the future. They're cheaper to build. They don't have near as big of a land footprint, even as the nuclear power plants, and could add a lot to our reliability.
And John, thanks for coming on, and good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Well, thank you so much, James. I really appreciate the honor of being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.